Good evening. When I first thought that I might be interested in Zen practice many years ago, I was curious and had some interest, you know, mild interest in this thing, maybe like some of you. And so at first I read some stories, some Zen stories, and I read some philosophy, Buddhist philosophy, but I wasn't too serious. I didn't go very deep in my reading or my studies, and mostly I was a bit superficial years ago. I was doing it for curiosity and interest, maybe a little bit of excitement. It was kind of fun to talk about Zen, you know. Can talk about it at coffee breaks, at parties, at work. And so I read some books and I read some sutras. I did feel some connection. Didn't know what it was, but I kind of liked the viewpoint. But I didn't really understand what I was reading, what I was talking about. It was a little bit confusing because it didn't seem to relate to anything that I was familiar with. These stories of thousands of years ago or hundreds of years ago in a remote place, eccentric guys in robes running around doing very odd things, fun to read about, but I couldn't connect to it really. And on top of that, the idea of actually doing Zen practice, it's a very remote idea. You know, that I felt you could go to Japan and do it. That's pretty remote, I thought. That's out of the question. And the books I read, philosophy and stories and parables and legends and myths, and didn't seem to talk about meditation, which I discovered later was the key, the heart of the whole thing. Maybe it was the translations I was reading, or maybe I just didn't see it. I don't know. So the whole business was a bit removed. So I didn't carry it around in my mind at all, just a little bit of a pastime. But then I had the opportunity to start practice, and I met the, you know, our founder, Suzuki Roshi, and then something changed. Well, this morning, you know, in the mornings after meditation here, some of us go over to Starbucks for coffee, and this morning somebody brought with her little book of his, Suzuki Roshi's, very short sayings, very short stories. And we remember them fondly because they are unique, and they express the view of a person who seems who had something, who expressed something quite unique, unique to us, unique to this culture. And today we appreciate what he said more and more. We appreciate what he said. We understand it more and more. But back in those days, when I was first starting and when he was first here, you know, I met him and I said, "Oh, he looks authentic." You know, this middle-aged Japanese man in robes, and he said things that he seemed really authentic. He seemed to know something, I thought. And so I thought, I expected, oh, he's going to clarify everything for me. He's going to make things clear. He's going to explain the teachings, and he's going to explain the philosophy in some kind of way that, you know, I will understand. And I was expecting him to explain in a 20th century way, logically, analytically, step by step. And I thought, well, he'll do that and I will understand Buddhism. And then I would be smarter and wiser. But he never discussed philosophy. He didn't unravel the teachings. He never explained enlightenment, which was in the books. Never explained it. He didn't even talk about how to get it. Instead, he emphasized the meditation. He emphasized sitting. Putting our body and mind in this posture. And being still. That's what he emphasized. And he emphasized the need to practice. Something that he called practice. And I didn't understand the meaning of that. Practice? What does that mean? Practice? But I became more involved in it because I felt like he knew something and he could show us something, make something clear. And his personality, his manner, you could really trust him. Everybody trusted him. Just his way encouraged trust. Initially I was very disappointed not to get easy explanations, like I thought I was going to get all laid out, like from a lesson plan. So that didn't come, which meant the only thing I could do was start sitting and pay attention. See what unfolds. And I eventually discovered that Zen, this practice, is not something that can be compared to other activities. I discovered that the point of the practice, the point of Zen practice, was to open up our lives to everything without restriction and without limitation. And to see things deeply, not superficially. I discovered that as we do this practice more and more and little by little, we begin to see how we can open up our life and how we have been limited. And it's a marvelous gift to see how we've been limiting our life. So the practice, I learned, was a way to help us see things as they really are, without bias, without limits, and without adding our own special feelings or our own special desires. In other words, to see the world free of conditioning, our own conditioning and the conditioning that the world tries to put on us from the time we were small to the in our homes, to the workplaces that we go, to wherever we go, there's a kind of conditioning. You know, the culture wants everybody to fit So there's a kind of conditioning, and that's okay, but we have to be free of it. Not let it take away our ability to see things clearly, free of conditioning. So eventually realize that this mind of no bias, no limitation, no prejudice, this should be the foundation of our life. And I realized that all the things that I had read the time before was trying to tell me this, but I didn't get it. But with the practice, it started to come clear. And I learned something that surprised me quite a bit when I realized it. Actually, this practice by itself has no meaning. But we do not live in a vacuum, and we do not live in a cave where nothing happens. We're always in relationship with each other, with people, and with things. And if we have practice, then when something arises in our life, some relationship or some event occurs, when we have practice, when we have to face something, the practice then can be expressed. By itself, practice means nothing. There's no meaning in isolation, but because we are here in an ongoing world, then the practice has meaning. And when we bring our practice, sincerely to the world of relationships, then we will see the meaning of it. But if we don't take our practice to the world of relationships, we won't see the meaning. This is why when we first start practice, we don't get it, because we treat it as a kind of standalone activity when we first come across it. It's only when it starts to be folded into our everyday life that we begin to understand the meaning of our spiritual practice. So Suzuki Roshi emphasized sitting. He really was saying, just trust your practice. Trust your sitting practice. Put yourself into it. Put your body and your mind into practice. Then your practice will be like a clear pond, like a still pond. When something appears to a pond, to a clear pond, the calm water will reflect what appears. It will reflect the nature of things without distortion, without filtering. In other words, the clear pond sees things as they are. And our zazen is like that. Zazen enables us to see things as they really are. Without this practice, this mindful practice, the things of our life are more like pictures, representations. We see them, but we don't see their real meaning. Without practice, the things of our life won't be seen as reality. But when we have zazen mind in our life, things become real. Things become alive and real. So the founder of this school of of Zen is Dogen. He lived in the 13th century, and one of his writings, I guess it was a lecture that he gave, it says, its title is Painting of a Rice Cake. Painting of a Rice Cake. And he says, he starts by saying, a painting of a rice cake cannot satisfy hunger. Of course, painting can't satisfy hunger. And even if we see a very beautiful painting, we cannot be nourished, deeply nourished, by the picture of something. We can't be nourished by the painting of a cake, or the painting of a hamburger, or the painting of a bowl of rice. And what Dogen was saying is, without this practice, what you see in your life is nothing more than a painted cake, and it won't satisfy you. And without practice, what we feel nourishes us doesn't really nourish us. It's as if we're eating nothing but white bread and potato chips. It fills us up, but no nourishment. But with practice, then we can have homemade bread, and our life can be enriched. You know, years ago when the Tassajara bread book was written, there was a lot of excitement. Even today, there's a great deal of interest in the Tassajara bread book. And when you make those breads, it's wonderful. And you know you're eating something substantial. You really feel nourished by a bread out of those recipes. Very often when newcomers come to practice here, they always ask, why does your morning meditation start so early? Why is 5:30 starting time so important? It's a natural question. When you don't yet understand the practice, you wonder about the so-called inconvenience of it. So it is important to understand the foundation of the practice. How is it to be expressed? So Zazen starts here, like it does in the ancient and traditional monasteries. Zazen starts here before the activities of your daily life have begun. When your mind has not yet engaged in the busyness of daily life, when your mind is still unmoving. So you get up, when the alarm rings, you wash your face, use the restroom, and come here. You don't open your email. You don't make a cup of tea. You don't read the newspapers. Just come. Before it gets engaged. And in that way, we have a better chance of experiencing everything coming from emptiness, from the pure and undifferentiated expression of our true nature. So we come early in the dark, before daily life has had a chance to carry us away. For those of us who feel part of this place, we feel that, you know, we don't say it, but we know that Kanon Do should not be a painted cake. This place is beyond something to be admired. It's a nice place. People like it. Building is nice. People are nice. The grounds, everything is nice. And it's easy to like it, to admire it. Oh, that's pretty nice. But we're beyond that. Kanon Do is beyond a place to be admired. Kanon Do is a place and an activity and a practice that provides nourishment. Should provide nourishment. That's why Kanon Do is here, to provide nourishment. And that's why we emphasize sitting before dawn, when we can really take nourishment. And that's why we emphasize care in our relationships, caring, so we can nourish each other. This is Buddhist practice. This is our tradition. And we are finding a way to continue this tradition in the modern world. As we know from in our own experience, as we go from place to place and job to job, as we move around and meet more and more people, we know that it's a tendency of human beings to emphasize themselves, to emphasize what we call the self. And much as in psychology has been written about the problems of ego and self, notions of self. So people always seem to be talking about what I want, what I need, what it is I understand. This self is not something real. This small self is like a painting of a rice cake. This self that we emphasize so much and that we get caught up in cannot nourish us. When we begin to feel that in our life, then we start looking at practice. Don't feel nourished by emphasizing ourselves, and we say, where is the nourishment? So Buddhism does not emphasize self. It emphasizes selflessness. So if somebody comes to the practice with some confusion or difficulty or unhappiness or not quite clear how to proceed in life, the practice is not concerned with, you know, fixing the self. The practice emphasizes going beyond concept of self. We talk about the self only to illustrate its opposite. We talk about the self only to illustrate selflessness. The best way for somebody to fix themselves is to drop off any idea of self, because the idea of self doesn't nourish. It's like a painting. So in Buddhism and in our practice, selflessness is how we see things as they really are, without limitation. With selflessness, we don't get caught up in appearances, in the appearance of things. We can admire things, and we can admire the beauty of things, and the delight that this beauty gives us, but we don't get caught in the appearances. And we try not to get caught in the idea of self, myself. Then we can see things as they are. And this is selflessness. So when we say, we talk about selflessness or no self, that doesn't mean we don't exist. It means to exist as we really are before there's an idea of self. So we are not just a painting. But if we can't go beyond the notion if we place too much emphasis on personal self, we really don't exist. We are like a painting when we are caught up in self. And also, when we emphasize no self, when we emphasize not getting caught up in the ideas of the ego, it doesn't mean we're forgetting all about how we should be, how we should express ourselves in daily life. Our way of practice is much like the bodhisattva of compassion called Kanan or Kuan Yin or Avalokiteshvara. When Avalokiteshvara wants to help a man, he or she takes the form of a man. When Avalokiteshvara wants to help a woman, he or she takes the form of a woman. This is the mythology of the bodhisattva. Avalokiteshvara can take the shape of a man when necessary. Take the shape of a woman, to be that flexible, to be so flexible. In Chinese Zen, there is an expression, to be like a heron in the snow, means be like a white bird in the snow. Can't see the bird. The bird blends in with the snow, totally harmonious with its surroundings. This is the meaning of selflessness. And this is the kind of feeling that Suzuki Roshi used to give to people. Oh, he just fits right in. No, he doesn't stand out. There's no self. He's a heron in the snow. Blends right in. So when people are like snow, we should be like snow. When people are of some other color, we should be that color. In other words, to be with others without prejudice or without judgment. Somebody is clever. We want to be with them at their level. When somebody is not so clever, we are with them at that level. Like a heron in the snow. Not ourselves standing out, just being present. So we should be with each other without prejudices or biases or discrimination, without ideas of discrimination. And that's how we can help each other. Without doing anything special, without performing magic. So what we have is our practice that comes from our quiet sitting, this posture and this mind, sitting quietly in the early morning. Letting go of the self. Letting go of being a painting. Just being a calm, clear mirror. And this is the bodhisattva way that can provide nourishment wherever it goes. Are there any questions tonight? Yes, Richard.
I'd like to share something about nourishment. I think your talk reminded me of this. I lived in Palo Alto. This was the early 90s. And moved into this house. There were two roommates, Jim and Matthew, and they were Greek Orthodox, and involved in the church, and they're always cooking, and gourmet, everything from scratch, every day, and like, they'd have parties and big meals, there's always plenty of food in the house, and they shared with me and with everyone, and they cooked a lot of bread. Christmas time, Matthew would make like 100 loaves of bread and take them to the church. And I came home one day and he was in the kitchen. And I asked, "What are you cooking, Matthew?" "I'm cooking hamburgers." And I went to my room. I came out later and he was baking bread. And I said, "I thought you were making hamburgers." He said, "I am." He was making the buns. So very thorough. And the house smelled great. And that's nourishment of the food, but it was nourishment of friendship. We had a lot of good times together. And you don't get that from McDonald's. Not those kind of hamburgers.
Those kind of hamburgers. Thank you. Yes, Anna.
Thank you for that lecture. I have a question. You know, it's a really popular Western saying to say, before you can be happy in a relationship, you need to have a good relationship with yourself. What would you say would be the Buddhist answer to that? Because it sounds pretty good when you hear that. It makes sense.
Good relationship with yourself. What does that mean? To have
spend good time getting to know yourself and spending time with yourself. tonight you talked about how our practice isn't in a cave, and it's best expressed with your relationship with others and the selflessness, but our practice can also help with that inner talk with yourself and knowing yourself. So I think it does apply to that relationship with yourself, kind of. You can work on that.
We can have, we have good relationships with each other when we can go beyond concerns of ourself. When we're free of concerns for ourself, when we have that kind of relationship with ourself, then we're open to others. We're not distracted or pulled away by concerns for ourselves. So even though we may be carrying around some ideas of things we have to do or things we have to take care of or some difficulties, if we can set them aside in our relationships, then we have a good relationship. So it's like we tell ourselves, don't worry. Don't worry about that thing that's bothering you right now. Concern yourself with this one. And the self that hears itself saying, don't worry, has to say, okay, I'll put that aside. So we have to be friendly to ourselves in that way. We have to listen to ourselves. Thank you. Yes, please.
So you mentioned bringing Zazen into daily life instead of it just being a standalone activity. What does that mean to bring it into daily life?
Well, if you become interested in Zazen and have the idea that, oh, I'll do that, you know, in the building, in this building or at home. I'll do my Zazen and then I get up and then I can forget about it and go to work. And that means we're not taking our practice into our life. And then it has no meaning. It's just something you do at a certain time of day or when it's convenient, and you do it and you cross it off your to-do list. It's not like that. It's our practice is something to express, to be expressed, whatever we do, whoever we're with. And like Anna was talking about our relationships, so we want to bring our practice to relationship. So if we see our practice as something separate from the things we do every day, it has no life. So what the kind of one of the things we try to do is take our practice that we learn about here, take it into our life, but all the stuff of our daily life that can create confusion and stress and all that, we don't bring it here. Well, of course it accompanies us, but we try not to give it life. We say, okay, stay there, go. So we take the practice there, but there stays there. You know, if we don't take our practice into our life or try to, then the practice is the painting of a rice cake and there's no nourishment. We have to make an effort to take it. Thank you. Yes, Travis?
Could you please say more about being free of conditioning and how that works in your life and in coming back to the practice? You talked about the clear pond and the seeing things as they are. Sometimes we leave the pond and come back, and I just often question whether we can be completely free of conditioning.
In Buddhism, there are some guiding principles, just like there are in Christianity and Judaism, some ways of behaving, 10 commandments, 10 precepts. And when we look at the Buddhist precepts, they look very prohibitive. Don't do this, don't do that, don't do that, don't do that. And if we are taught those precepts in a very strict way, it's like somebody's trying to condition us to be this way. But actually, the attitude we have in our practice about those precepts is, they're not rules, they're suggestions. The 10 suggestions. So that you are free to choose for yourself how to behave, knowing there are some guidelines. But to look at the 10 precepts and say, oh, I must do that, I cannot vary. This is being conditioned, even though the intention is kindness or compassion. It's a conditioning. I must follow these rules. When we do that, we're not thinking for ourselves. We're not exploring. We're not making our own discoveries. So we have guidelines. You know, parents and relatives and people teach us things, try to teach us things. But if they teach us these things as guidelines rather than as rules, we won't be conditioned. But if they teach us in too strict a way, our mind becomes rigid, and when we discover some rigidity, we try to soften that conditioning so that we can open up. Something like that.
What about the cultural values that are sort of undiscovered? At some point you come across things that you just took for truths that actually are fictional, actually, and you find that all of the culture actually runs on these kinds of guidelines that people don't really think seriously about. I was away for, you know, the break for the holidays, and came back to work this morning, and I was confronted with some of that. And only by being away was I able to have some perspective on it. So I know that the culture will be, at large, will be hard for me to for me to navigate, but it seems like with the practice, are we to find our way and to be free to choose the conditions that make our life nourish? Is that the challenge?
Well, rather than operate or live our life in a conditioned sense, we should always consider what's the appropriate thing to do right now. And the conditioned, the world around us may say, oh, well, this is what you should do right now, but if you really are involved in the situation, paying careful attention to it, and caring, you say, in this case, that is not the appropriate thing to do. That would create suffering. We want to not create suffering, we want to relieve suffering. So if the conditioned world is giving us a signal that we should behave in a way that we feel is inappropriate, then we have to go against the conditioning. So yes, we are always observing and trying to understand what's the best thing to do right now. So in that way, we should be independent. At the same time, cooperating with people and doing those things that benefit all of us. So it's so actually we are saying, Let's do these things together. This is how we can be together harmoniously. But if there's a special situation, I will have to make an adjustment. Yes, please.
Yes. On the subject of the self, it seems as though thinking of the self, at least a little bit, is a prerequisite of day-to-day existence. If I don't think about it, that I need food, I starve. I mean, I have to think about my desires a little bit in order to go through my day. My question is really this clarification of this sort of misconception. Is it that we think about others, or we think about, we stop thinking about ourselves, and we think about the needs of others, and those desires will naturally take care of themselves? Or are we doing things for the sake of others, so that, and by doing that, our day-to-day existence will naturally take care of itself? How do we balance the needs and demands of day-to-day existence, yet embrace this notion of selflessness?
Carry an attitude of caring. Let's start there. And all of those questions will resolve themselves moment by moment if you start with the fundamental attitude. So you care. And that means when you're hungry, you'll eat. And when somebody else is hungry, you'll feed them. And if we have a caring attitude, we won't have to worry too much about, am I being selfish? The caring attitude will carry us through, and we won't get trapped by selfishness. Thank you. Do we have announcements tonight?
We have, this is going to be